Thank you all. Thank you so much for the Arab American Cultural Center for inviting me and for organizing this timely and important conversation in about a country that is often not talked about that much, in part because there is a level of not much interest in the country itself, but in part also because of the complexity that exists in terms of narrating the existing issues there. I'll briefly walk you through some of the important issues that I think are worth highlighting. But I have three key disclaimers from the very beginning, so we're all on the same page. The first one is, it's a sneak peek into the current situation, and whatever I say is certainly, it won't serve the conflict and its complexity, its justice, because it really is complicated, and there are so many layers of tribal, religious, political, socioeconomic, regional tensions that in some ways could make it challenging to understand the full depth of the situation. But I'll try to walk you through, I'll offer you a sneak peek of the situation. The second thing, I cannot underemphasize the humanitarian situation there and how badly in shape it is in the context of Yemen. And Jihan will help me by talking more about that context, but it's really is sometimes what gets lost in conversations about conflicts is its impact on real people, and to what extent it certainly proves damaging. I myself have Yemeni family there. I come from Yemen. I have family there. I have friends. I have relatives. I've taught in one of the universities there for some time. So I'm deeply connected to Yemen, and I take it one day at a time, really, as far as connecting with what's going on, but at the same time making sense and reconciling with the fact that there is a disaster at the human level that's happening. So I won't be talking much about the humanitarian level. Jihan will be talking about that, but I just want to make sure that you keep that in mind. The third thing is, I'm not advocating for any warring party. I'm not a partisan. I don't highlight or advocate for any side. I'm really interested in understanding the full complexity that is surrounding the issue here. So please, and this is usually a moment of tension when I talk about Yemen, when I go to an audience from an audience to another, it's easy for people to start picking sides and define me or push me or corner me or confine me in a certain way. I'm trying to transcend all the polarizations that exist in Yemen as we speak. And please, if there is a tendency for oversimplification, I certainly don't want to buy that. But at the same time, excuse my oversimplification if I happen to do it in some way. This is an interesting book that I recommend reading for those of you who want to know the basics of what's going on in Yemen. It's a recently published book by Helen Lackner, Yemen in Crisis. But let me walk you very, very briefly about what happened. And I won't go, when it comes to the current conflict, you have to go back all the way to the 30s. Spoiler alert, but I won't be going back all the way to the 30s. I just go back to the 2011 moment, because it's a very important recent moment that I think helped shape in so many ways what's happening in this context we call Yemen. Yemen was part of a wave that crossed the Arab region, came to be known as the Arab Spring. In Yemen, it took a year-long process for youth to peacefully march in the streets and demand the ousting of the president who served more than 30 years as the president of the country and really centralized rule in such a way that disenfranchised so many communities. It was very peaceful, no much use of arm, nothing, nobody advocated for any calls for violence, and those efforts materialized to some extent in successfully by ousting that president, whose name is Saleh. Just, you probably want to remember that name. And the only way he stepped down a year later after a year-long protest is by handing the power to his vice president. This guy is from the north of Yemen. The vice president is from the south. So the move was supposed to be symbolic in the sense that early history of grievances between northerners and southerners were supposed to be reconciled by this president. But the transition proved really, really, really troublesome. There was a very long national dialogue that occurred as part of the transition through what came to be known as the National Dialogue Conference, with people that's supposed to have represented many peoples and many political parties and power players in the context. And the dialogue resulted in dividing the country with a proposal to divide the country into six regions with semi-autonomous rule. And these divisions are not divided necessarily according to religious lines. Sometimes they are divided according to linguistic, common areas thinking, historical, collective understandings of oneself. So these are basically the color-coded ones. These two colors were two regions that were part of what was the South in Yemen before 1990, because 1990 was the year that the South and the North united into what came to be known as the Republic of Yemen. And these other colors represented four separate regions within the North. There's a group that rejected this proposal of creating a federal system in which to resolve years of centralized governance in Yemen. Maybe it's about time to decentralize that power and by making it possible for people to rule themselves with the understanding that they still report to a federal government, right? The Houthis, led by this person, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, ended up rejecting this. And this is a tribal power that comes from the north of the north, came from all the way from this area, which borders Saudi Arabia, and marched using violence all the way to the capital of the Yemen capital, Sana'a, the control of that capital, and they kept marching, taking control of many, many places here in the south. They had a vision to control basically the whole situation. What happened is their advance, their march into the southern territories sparked some anxieties on the Saudis' part, in part because the then president Hadi fled to the south and basically sought support from the Saudis, who immediately already had a coalition, surprise, surprise, and that coalition constituted mostly of Arab countries, along with support from the U.S., some European countries, and Pakistan. And there were some oppositions, of course, happening along the way. That, since that moment, the coalition, the Houthis took control of the capital in September 2014, and the intervention, the Saudi-led coalition, took place in March 2015, and the promise was, let's end basically the Houthi control. Let's find ways to scale back the coup, because that's how it's been called, coup, basically, and introduce democracy, basically, reintroduce democracy into Yemen, which sounded so problematic for so many people who know a thing or two about Saudi Arabia and its track record of democracy and human rights. I don't want to sound dismissive in some way, because there were so many Yemenis who really were welcoming the Saudi support, right? I mean, the ex-president himself, the president himself, Hadi, called for Saudi intervention. And there was a celebration among some Yemenis in the south that there was an intervention on the part of the Saudis that helped somehow push back against Houthi ambition to take control of the scene. But that intervention brought a whole set of problems that people never thought of when they thought of the dynamics of the conflict. This is where things stand 40 years later. This is mostly the territory controlled by Hadi, the president who the Houthis kicked out of Sana'a. And this is and his alliances, Saudi-led alliances or coalition. And this is the area controlled by the Houthi and his alliances, basically, Houthi groups and their alliances. This is a very heavily populated area, so don't be fooled by the small geographic space compared to the south, right? Still, this is it seems at the face value of the situation that the country is stuck in a civil war, and that's how it's been defined, talked about, mediated, and argued that the country is undergoing a civil war between the Houthi on the one hand, and the Houthi and what they represent to that country, and the Hadi, the president who got ousted, and what he sort of represent. There are four interesting and important issues of complexities that I think are worth looking at in the Yemeni context. The first one is that we need to understand who are the Houthis, you know, because really what gets lost in the conversation usually is the fact that it's really complicated to understand who are the Houthis who control majority of the northern parts of the country. This is a very important book that I think anybody who wants to claim expertise in Yemen in some way or shape or form, or want to talk about the Houthis in any shape or form, has to at least read this book and look at the complexity of the situation. The book called Tribes and Politics in Yemen, A History of the Houthi Conflict. And it offers a very, very interesting account of the complexity of the identity of the Houthis in a way that blows a very important blow against the narrative that what's going on in Yemen is a sectarian conflict between Sunnis and Shias, because it's certainly not as simple as it may seem. That's how it's presented, that's how it's mediated in much of the regional media, but that's not necessarily how it is taking shape in the ground. I mean, yes, there was very important religious mobilization that Houthis have spearheaded as a group, in part to influence that came from Iran, ideological influence, but that was in a way a response to existing realities that were taking shape throughout the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, that in so many ways made it possible for the Houthis to organize in this way. The Houthis, people are defining them as Shia. Yes, they are Shia, but they're part of a Zaydi community that have been really known for 1,000 years as the Sunnis of the Shia and the Shias of the Sunnis. So they are the closest, really, of the Shia groups to the Sunni community, as opposed to the Shia that Shia version that Iran is presenting in the region. So there's been a very, very strong historical levels of tolerance that existed between Sunnis and Shias. There was a lot of intermarriages, and there was a lot of level of tolerance and understanding between the Zaydi community and the Shia and the Sunni community. And also, when we think of Zaydiism, which is again a branch of Shia theology, Zaydiism itself, by 1990s, by the decade of the 90s, it was no longer easily being narrated as a religious thing. For many tribes in the region, they would identify themselves as Zaydis, but at the same time, they would say, we are Sunnis, you know, we are Muslim Brotherhood. They identify with the Muslim Brotherhood way of thinking, and they would say, we're Zaydis in the traditional sense, in the tribal sense, in the traditional cultural sense, but not Zaydis in the religious sense. So when you look at this phenomenon of Zaydiism, which is Shiaism, it certainly is much more complicated in the Yemeni scene. And Houthis organized themselves in response to decades of disenfranchisement that Ali Abdullah Saleh, the ex-president, really managed to alienate so many around the country. Not only the Houthis, many people in the south, many people in the north along the way. There was a very importance was levied on centralized governance, and Houthis were led through what came to be known as the impact of the centralizing power were occurred in three ways. The economic deprivation of the Houthi communities, and politically marginalizing them, and isolating them even by not introducing roads and constructions that help connect their territories with the mainstream land in such a way. And Saleh's governance style was also in line of what came to be known as the politics of permanent crisis. He would pit groups against each other, basically. At some point, he mobilized Houthis against certain tribal sheikhs in their own territories, and at some point, he mobilized some Islamist Sunnis, for the most part, against Houthis. So there was a lot of dirty politics in the case of the ex-president done in such a way that really created conditions for this disaster. And there were some inner dynamics to the whole component. So when it comes to Houthi, it really is hard to understand them or depict them as primarily representative of Iran or as Shias. They are very Yemenis in every possible way. There are Yemenis who happen to, because of the set of circumstances they were presented with, advocate for certain realities. The impact of Saudi coalition, this is another important complexity that is there. It's easy for people to just reject the Saudi invasion, period, right? But the Saudi invasion came at a time when it was badly needed for some people in the south who really hated to see Houthis taking control. But at what cost was that invasion? That's the other reality that people are being faced with or seem to wrestle with on their daily basis. And some of the main impacts of that invasion is that it led or created conditions that people never expected, and there were unintended consequences to the invasion that people didn't foresee that made it especially challenging in some way to understand. So not only that the Saudi invasion made it clear that the war is, seems to be at least, about religious in nature, between sectarian primarily, between Sunnis and Shia, between Iran and Saudi Arabia. It's a proxy war, period. So it was easy to narrate it that way, but also created conditions for two small countries with supersized ambitions, Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, to be more specific, to bring their own regional ambitions Qatar wants to promote Muslim Brotherhood, Islamists, basically Sunni Islamist experiences across the region, and the United Arab Emirates have zero tolerance to Islamists. They both invested heavily in the conflict. So Saudi invasion sort of made that happen, further interventions, further disruptions going on. There was so much disruption to the infrastructure and cultural heritage that it exacerbated the humanitarian conditions for sure, and it rekindled deeply rooted grievances among Yemenis that goes all the way back to the 30s, because Saudi Arabia has been involved in Yemeni conflicts for quite some time. It goes, again, all the way back to the 30s. So, again, when it comes to thinking of Houthis and Saudis, you have to understand that in a complicated way. The U.S. factor, and this is the third issue, is I think it's an important one in the sense that since 2002, at the very least, the U.S. has led a very important and disruptive drone program that I think created so many opportunities for militias, Houthis included, to recruit in the name of fighting for the sake of Yemeni sovereignty, to fight against the U.S. aggression, right? And that has been problematic on its own, but add to that that the fact that the United States has decided to hand a blank check or offer a blank check to the Saudis and to the coalition by basically enabling them to run the scene in Yemen without fact check made it especially challenging. What complicates things further for Yemeni Americans in this context is the sense of surveillance that people and communities are being dealing with for quite some time. What remains to be another area of, I think, that needs to be understood and thought of clearly is that there's a lot of pessimism that's going on in the context, but also there is a lot of activism and search for advocacy. Yes, when we think of pre-2014, before the rise of Houthis and the advent of the Saudis, youth activism was very vibrant because they brought down a dictator, right? But at the same time, what happened because of the war is that people and advocacy groups started seeing harsh reality. And that is that if you were to present a narrative that challenges the status quo, depending on where you are in the country, you're instantly being met with coercive measures, whether surveillance, crackdown, threats, detention, sometimes even physical injury. Part of what is the challenging about the whole issue with resistance in the Yemeni context is the polarization that exists, not only in Yemen, but also here in the U.S. context. And Jihan probably would be the best to talk about that, to look at how polarized the environment is, really, how easy it is to promote or to transcend at least the current divisiveness that exists, not only in Yemen, but also among Yemeni diasporas here in the United States. Of course, there are so many other challenges ranging from funding and recruitment pressures for certain youth and living emergencies. People have to feed their own families, so they quit activism, they quit advocacy, and start focusing more on how they feed their own family in some way. And I will end with this slide to just show you some of the existing efforts that people are taking, youth primarily, to produce some changes in the ground, in Yemeni context, or here in the United States. For the most part, activism that again, as I said earlier, that promote disruptive change to the status quo, whether in Houthi territories or Saudi-controlled regions, they are immediately faced with detention or sometimes torture or silence in so many ways, right? But there have been some smart initiatives that have gained some attention and receptivity to some extent. Those that rallied around the importance of producing change to attain some sort of security like Aden Security Alliance and Aden Without Arms got some sort of support and success, some level of success. Those that rallied around humanitarianism also managed to pull through some of the weight they put into their projects. There are some organizations like Youth Without Borders that managed to produce some campaigns and awareness issues about the importance of participation in society and thinking of one's community beyond divisiveness, but they haven't really had much success in changing things in serious ways. There have been some attempts, like the Yemeni Film Festival that was done, almost done really. There was a great chance, but Houthis shut it down last minute. It was such a wonderful, wonderful work. Some political aspects to the activism, Jihan will probably talk more about that. And there were some social media campaigns that tried to look to imagine, at least, can we imagine a way to think of Yemen or narrate Yemen beyond this Sunni Shia Houthi Saudi or Houthi Hadi attention? How can I be critical of one aspect without being labeled as traitor or necessarily sympathizer of a group at the cost of other? What it means to rally around what it means to be Yemeni, you know, those campaigns are manufactured to address people's understanding of their own identity, and it remains to be seen to what extent they'll be successful. Thank you so much.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the current political moment, what the negotiations look like, and what the political settlement might be. And as a piece of that, working in the community here, we find oftentimes that the diaspora mirrors so much what's in the homeland. And so what does that look like right now in the Yemeni American community without implicating anyone? what does that look like in terms of, you know, popular community institutions and maybe people who were more engaged when there were popular struggles over the last 2 years in Yemen?
I can talk very about loaded.
Right? You are very embedded in that, right?
I'm super involved in the Memsa community in the Bay Area, and because I'm Yemeni, I'm heavily more even entrenched in the Yemeni American community, and we're very divided, to be real with you. You know, you have those that, and it just goes to show you how durable and strong propaganda is, that an imam of a masjid will say that the Houthis are subhumans, and that they're here to, you know, that they need to be annihilated, and then folks will follow. Mm-hmm. So then people who want to speak against the Saudi-led coalition, for example, who are also in disagreement with the Houthis, they'll call them Irani supporters or Houthi supporters or whatever. So we're very divided, and a lot of people in the community follow positions based on their spiritual leadership. So, and then again, spiritual leadership, they're people, right? So they are also corrupt. But honestly, the majority in the Bay Area and New York and in Michigan, because we're all kind of like a community, we stay in touch, a lot of them do support the Saudi-led coalition. A lot of misinformation and people are kind of afraid of being a minority. And those that take my position are a minority, and we're attacked and bashed a lot. So that's kind of how we exist right now.
I just want to complicate that a little bit further, because, I mean, it also depends who you talk to, right? I mean, there are communities, and what regions do these populations that Jihan just referred to come from, and what sort of grievances they've had developed over the years, you know, against the Houthis. And so possibly still is community contingent, and what sort of people they come from, you'd see a certain message. But yes, there is a very, very acute sense of polarization and mistrust, and that's really what characterizes the Yemeni scene, that there is a deep-seated sense of mistrust that has been already building for years. And honestly, the whole mess we are in is a direct result of that mistrust. Now, add to that the layers of regional interventions, it complicated the situation even further. Now, really, it's no longer even an issue between Iran and Saudi Arabia anymore. Now you have a third layer, which is Qatar and United Arab Emirates in engaging in the scene, complicating the situation even further. So the narration is not as neatly as Houthi versus Hadi, although that's how it's mediated, right? I mean, globally. And that's part of the challenge to any existing efforts to create a reconciliation or resolution, is that usually at the negotiation table, who sits those representatives of these two authorities? While in fact, in the ground, you're looking at multitude of alliances, groups that may constantly shift allegiances depending on regional dynamics and local politics, issues of interest, economic interests, and there's so many variables, right? So there is that challenge, the challenge of trying to reduce the conflict to an existing tension between two powers, and whatever negotiations that happen, currently led by and mediated by the United Nations, seem to take place between these two opposing parties. But when it comes to imposing any settlements on the ground, then you see a multitude of parties that emerge that challenge any resolutions that exist. Right now, there have been talks for months already between the Houthis and the representatives of the Hadi government, supported by the Saudi coalition, to at least create a zone, create a space in the port of Hodeidah, which is a very important port that through which lots of humanitarian support and actually lots of food supply gets into the country, is demilitarized. And there's been push in that direction. But also that how to realize that in the ground has been subject to lots of going back and forth, you know. So there is that aspect to the discussions, and the assumption that if that's resolved, that issue is resolved, and the UN steps in and creates a UN sort of monitored force there that is demilitarized in a sense, then maybe that would create a possibility for ongoing negotiations about the other sites, because there are so many other conflict zones. Hodeidah, the port, is not the only one, right? So, but again, it remains to be seen to what extent will this be realized and whether it will be successful or not. Now, moving to other conflict zones, then really you start seeing different dynamics to conflicts. In a city like Taiz, for example, which is a city I come from, the politics of the tension is very, very multi-layered, and it's quite impossible to sort of dumb it down to Houthi versus Hadi negotiations, because almost I can guarantee you, if the negotiation is only restricted to these two representatives, they'll almost fail, because there is the UAE-backed militias there, and there is the Saudi-backed militias there, and there is also some regional tensions and power players that don't even care about these regional politics. So there must be a recognition of a framework for negotiations moving forward, and I hope there will be a recognition at some point of this, that negotiations have to happen at different levels, not just between two major representatives of these different parties. But the hope is that whatever is going on now will open the door for reconciliation, hopefully, you know. I mean, they say to be pessimistic, to be optimistic. I would love to read the situation in a very optimistic way, but reality sometimes pushes towards pessimism. But again, the population, to sum it, the Yemeni population is fluctuating between hope and despair. And that's really where we're at this moment. And just to follow that, and others feel free to talk about this, and this is a very, very timely conversation to have, right? And I thought it was already timely, and every step of the way, you think that's timely for emerging alliances across the world. And I thought the moment was perfect when I saw people storming airports and in defense of or in rejection of the first executive order. That was a very, very beautiful moment where it was possible to create a possibility to transcend one's own, being into a moment of activism in some way. And I think the moment is right. The moment is always right. Start thinking seriously about fostering alliances that transcend, specific politics or specific locations. And I would love to see major national organizations that advocate for rights to help contribute to the conversation. I would love to see scholarly organizations to help contribute to that. I would love to see institutions and centers like this to help contribute to those emerging alliances in some way. So your call is really timely, and I certainly join you in that call.
Folks have asked me, why don't we see outrage like we've seen in a Vietnam War? Why don't we see people in the streets? I'm like, well, and I hate to say it, Yemen is the forgotten war on purpose. It's not like an accident. I was telling you guys earlier that, with this, in this case, the U.S. is supporting the Saudi-led coalition with intelligence support, operational support, targeting assistance. Until recently, we stopped mid-air refueling. We're also selling arms. So Raytheon, Lockheed Martin, those manufacturers of bombs are the ones that are killing Yemenis. So I think pushing that into mainstream will not promote patriotism and those warm feelings that we should feel about being American and stuff. So I think that's a reason why a lot of folks don't know. You know what I mean? Like when I'm talking to people, even when I make congressional visits to staffers, they're like, Yemen? They don't even know. You know what I mean? So I feel like it's going to take so much awareness, first of all, in order to educate the masses and then to hopefully mobilize, because the media has been really silenced on the impact on the ground.
I can. I mean, it's really important to recognize the damage that the U.S. has done in Yemen. Even though people may seem to dismiss that damage and blame it on the Saudis or the Emiratis indirectly, I mean, if you just look at the role that the U.S. has played since 2002, you know, way before the Iraq War, I mean, Yemen was the early site where drone program was enacted. In such a damaging way that really disrupted the country, the way Yemenis were treated throughout the process, whether through direct U.S. involvement in the conflict or indirect support of these powers, certainly contributed to the humanitarian crisis that we experience today. And Jihan is right that what seems to be happening at the congressional levels, the level of disturbance that occurs at the U.S. political system certainly has its own impact on how negotiations take place and the sort of emergency that results in the real ground. So, yes, there is a direct correlation between how the U.S. is conducting itself, how it has conducted itself, real-life consequences in the Yemeni context.
I would encourage allies to support impacted community members and their work. Whether it's the BDS campaign of the Palestinian movement against Israeli occupation, support their work, follow their lead. I think that is the best way to be a solid ally, is to just really support impacted folks, because we are our best advocates. You know what I mean? I think what we've been lacking is the support and the awareness, and I think that's where everybody comes. Bob back in, he can definitely support our work.
What are the ambitions in Yemen and in your... do you think it's posing a threat to Yemen's sovereignty in any way?
I'll try to put it simply there. So the way things are narrated is that you have the Houthis who are controlling the scene, and then you have Hadi, who is the president, legitimate president that is internationally recognized and backed by the Saudi Arabian coalition, right? That's usually the narrative. And then there's a clash in the ground between confrontation, militarized confrontation, and let's say Houthis are kicked out of certain areas. Who gets to occupy those areas that Houthis leave then becomes an issue of difference among the coalition players themselves. So not in every liberated zone, liberated from Houthi control, you end up necessarily with a strong Hadi control. What you in fact start seeing is another level of disruption, another level of conflict between different players. This time, they don't even involve Houthis, but involve the coalition members themselves. So in the south, for example, you see United Arab Emirates all of a sudden care less about Hadi and Hadi's authority and care more about building a different group, or enabling a different group, in this case, southern separatists who want to recreate southern state. In the case of Taiz, for example, in the areas where Houthis are left, the United Arab Emirates would empower certain militant groups that don't even care about, you know, the issues of south or north, but care about their enmity to Muslim Brotherhood. And along the way, it's the Muslim Brotherhood in those sites who could eventually be the inheritor of the scene in some way, right? Qatar supports those Muslim Brotherhood people. But the United Arab Emirates then simultaneously, in order to avoid the Brotherhood from occupying those spaces, the liberated spaces from Houthis, then end up supporting new militias, creating, funding new militias that create different realities, that create different levels of conflicts. So then it becomes less about really fighting Houthis, fighting Iran, and becomes more about dealing with the messy transition that occurs as a result of out of every transition. To the extent that makes you wonder, really, is there even a strategic vision behind this Saudi-led coalition? That's why it led so many people to say, you know what, yes, Saudi might have brought some great slogans to the scene, but what we ended up dealing with is really, really enabling regional powers to step in, to recruit more, to invest more in disrupting the societies. And all, no matter how you look at it, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Emirates, the United States, now Russia is investing, seems to be investing in the scene. Sovereignty is really at the center of it all. Yemenis seem to be the most who pay the price in terms of retaining their own sense of sovereignty, right?
So there is this sense of urgency that the community is feeling, and a sense of wanting to take it to the streets and release some of their anger and frustration, and they're doing things they never did before. Speaking at protests, I've born and raised in the city, and we don't see that much. And they're also coordinating and organizing with other coalitions, other impacted communities. So there is this sense of realizing our political power and mobilizing communities, and something that hasn't been done before, and it is promising. And that's how the Yemeni Alliance Committee was born. There's another organization in San Francisco called the Yemeni Association. Yemeni Association of...
Dad, you mean?
There's this sense of we really need to do something about it. It's not just the ban, it's the war. I mean, we're just being hit by all these fronts, and we need to do something about it. So how we sustain it, I suppose it's, just continue to build momentum. And it's something that I've seen since Trump was elected that has been pretty consistent. Yeah.
I mean, the only thing I would say is that there is a very positive energy out there, you know. There are differences, there are divisions among Yemeni Americans about how to find ways to create a positive results. But I think there are venues for to converge those two forces together. And really, we are stuck in that moment now. How can we find ways to converge those two energies in a way that is somehow, it transcends, you know, the Yemeni divisions, but at the same time engages more with the daily concerns that they're concerned with, you know, so.
It's taken a lot to get to where we are. It's like that in Michigan and New York as well. I think that's a good question. I mean, building community with other impacted communities. Like the sister said, really just conjoining our efforts and, I think taking... something that my friend who's with NIAC has been doing is putting Iranian Americans, for example, in political office, like having them hold political positions. I think that's a really good way to really sway policy in a real way. But other than, I think community building is like hard work, you know what I'm saying? It takes time. This is a community that comes from a place where dissent is not allowed, where we've had a dictator for 30-something years. It's taken a lot to really get up there to just vote, you know what I'm saying, lobby even, create spaces, funded spaces, sustainable ones, and then really just, coordinate and collaborate with other impacted community members across the board, because we're all impacted by these policies one way or another. Unless you had another idea, I'm really happy to hear.
Please help me thank Alex Cooper.